Palestinians are telling the truth about how many people are killed. I'm sure innocents have been killed, and it's the price of waging a war. I think we should be incredibly careful. I think not we, the Israelis should be incredibly careful to be sure that they're focusing on going after the folks that are the propagating this war against Israel. And it's against their interest when that doesn't happen. But I have no confidence in the number that the Palestinians are using.
Yes, folks, there is Genocide Joe there with one of the most vile things he said in his first term in office here. He doesn't know if he can trust the death tolls we are seeing, which where they stand now is about half the civilian casualties in about 2.5 weeks as Russia's invasion of Ukraine, about 5,000 plus, you know, who knows, give or take some people stuck under rubble. Some people may be overly estimated by Palestinian authorities, but I will say that the good old Washington Post, which I think Joe Biden has heard of, did put this out on the 24th, and I'll scroll to this paragraph. Everyone uses figures from the Gaza Health Ministry because those are generally proven to be reliable, said Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. In the times in which we have done our own verification of numbers for particular strikes, I'm not aware of any time which there has been some major discrepancy. So what is different? It's not the track record. It is the PR imperatives for the continued slaughter of Palestinian civilians. So and really gross there.
Extremely gross and dehumanizing. And I just add really briefly, Matt, that, like, you know, what's the point in doing all this? It's literally so that media organizations from now on, whenever they write about the death tolls that are being reported from the Gaza Health Ministry, they say the Hamas-run health ministry to try to discredit those numbers. The fact that Joe Biden is supporting these bombings and mass slaughtering of civilians and human beings in Gaza is disgusting enough, right? I think that that's the most disgusting thing. But in terms of statements, I mean, this is as heinous as it gets. And I know every time we've talked about this, we've mentioned the fact that there's something so hard about us reporting on it, but even just sort of living in the world right now, we all know why they do it. We know how, the mechanism, all this kind of stuff, but it does make you feel really crazy when you see people like Biden and our government just regularly lying in the way that they are about what is very visible and clear for all to see.
It's legit sickening. Jules T points out, you know, the numbers far exceed 5K. Yeah, that, and they're going up fast. And I should point that for the people watching this on a delay, that the long-term effects of the siege, have already started kicking in, but are only going to take more and more lives from here on out.
And as we're talking about with I was just going to say, as we're going to talk about with Davison in just a little bit, the fact that, you know, these hospitals are being shut down, are unable to take care of people, they don't have electricity and things that they need. It means that there are going to be significant deaths of people who need, you know, basic treatments, people on dialysis, people who need certain kind of medicines to survive. And I know I don't need to tell it to this audience, but sometimes I feel like Americans need to be reminded of this. You know, all of the health requirements that go into keeping us alive, right? Things like dialysis, things like insulin, exist in Gaza too. And when you basically prevent people from having access to that, they die. You know, so that is an added, death toll to this. And again, it's intentional. When you hear things like the IDF, chiding, the United Nations saying, oh, you guys should get some fuel from Hamas. We're no longer going to let you do humanitarian work in Gaza. Understand that that is saying, hey, we want those numbers to go up about how many people are dying in Gaza. It's some of the most evil, brutal stuff you'll see.
I think, and I'm not the only one, there's a genocide expert in Jewish Currents arguing that what we're seeing is a textbook genocide. That's what we're seeing right now. But also just to point out that, you know, it's not just Israel, but also America that has a lot of culpability here. there was this a funny tweet by UAE Exotic Falconry and Finance, which is a sort of parody political Twitter account. I don't really know exactly how to explain the bit, I'll be honest, but they but they occasionally post really funny things like this. And he was quoting Obama. He did a thread, you know, that didn't include the word ceasefire. He includes this Willem Dafoe. Is this from Boondock Saints? Or I'm not sure what this is from, but, you know, I'm something of a hospital bomber myself. The story of this, and I remember this when I first started at Majority Report. This is one of the early stories, or this was an active story around this time. And we go to Kunduz, October 3rd, 2015. And here, Medicine Sans Frontier, that means Doctors Without Borders in French. October 3rd, 2015, U.S. airstrikes destroyed our trauma hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing 42 people. I will let one of the doctors there fill us in the immediate aftermath of this.
In Kunduz, our patients burned in their beds. Our doctors, nurses, and other staff were killed as they worked. Our colleagues had to operate on each other. One of our doctors died on an improvised operating table, an office desk, while his colleagues tried to save his life. Today, we pay tribute to those who died in this abhorrent attack, and we pay tribute to those Doctors Without Borders staff who, while watching their colleagues die and with their hospital still on fire, carried on treating the wounded. This was not just an attack on our hospital, it was an attack on the Geneva Conventions. This cannot be tolerated. These conventions govern the rules of war and were established to protect civilians in conflict, including patients, medical workers, and facilities. It is precisely because attacking hospitals in war zones is prohibited that we expected to be protected. And yet 10 patients, including 3 children, and 12 of our staff were killed in the aerial raids. The facts and circumstances of this attack must be investigated independently and impartially, particularly given the inconsistencies in the U.S. and Afghan accounts of what happened over recent days. We cannot rely only on internal military investigations by the U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces. Today, we've announced that we're seeking an investigation into the Kunduz attack by the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission. We are calling on President Obama to consent to the fact-finding commission. Doing so will send a powerful signal of the U.S. government's commitment to and respect for international humanitarian law and the rules of war. This is not only about the deaths of our staff and patients in Kunduz, it is about the safety and security of our medical teams around the world working in conflict zones. It is about our patients in Afghanistan, our patients in Yemen, our patients in Ukraine, and our patients in Syria. Today we are fighting back for the respect of the Geneva Conventions. As a medical humanitarian organization, we are fighting back for the sake of our patients. We need you, as members of the public, to stand with us to insist that even wars have rules.
Now, you might have heard there, if you're listening closely, a pretty explicit and direct call for an independent investigation. Did Obama give him that? No. What we did was let the Pentagon investigate itself. The Pentagon said, a bit of fog of war, a bit of a whoopsie, a bit of a over enthusiasm from people down the chain of command. We're going to punish them, of course, but, you know, up top we don't condone such things. And oh, by the way, we'll do reparations for the folks of you who have had people die. And that is in the form of $6,000. If somebody died, about $3,000 if someone was maimed. So, you know, buy a Mac Pro if you lost your family member. Here is a clip from NPR interview with some of the folks about this here.
I want the Americans to clarify why they hit us. What was the reason? We were just there to serve. They bombed us while we were asleep.
Niazi's now too disabled by his injuries to work. He says so far he's received no compensation from the U.S., nor have the families of the doctors, patients and caretakers killed in the hospital bombing, and nor have the many others who were injured. The U.S. military has made what it calls condolence payments. These are one-off payments to express sympathy and meet immediate expenses. Families of the dead were given $6,000. The injured got $3,000. Niazi thinks these condolence sums are derisory.
It's ridiculous assistance. It is ridiculous and insulting.
Jonathan Whittle of Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, it's also known, says other victims feel the same way.
The feedback that we've had from families and from people inside the facility has been that it's not sufficient.
So, of course, Israel's not above it. Neither are we. And ultimately, you know, accountability in the form of whoopsie, even though we didn't give that independent investigation, there's some reporting that maybe even in the plane itself, which just so people can have it in your imaginations, one of these guys, let me just present this. It was one of these, AC-130. And I saw some rumors that the people in the plane were even wondering aloud, is this legal what we're doing? Of course, you know, Pentagon independent investigation, and this is what it looked like to bomb a hospital with one of those things. I think we talked a little bit with Derek Davison after we got off about staring into the abyss. And like very much, we are not by any means people that have the hardest at this moment. But this shit sucks, and it has to stop. And the time to put the foot down is always 2015 was one of those. We should have, and we just don't. We have these militaries that are completely lawless and completely. Scoff at the idea that they'd be accountable about this sort of thing. And this is the world we live in now.
You know, there's so much, about what's going on to focus on, right? And first and foremost, it's saving Palestinian lives who, as we're speaking right now, are still directly under threat. More bombing, of land war, and of this attempt to eradicate that people. And yes, you know what? Like, yes, these are the words you use in this situation, because even before this attack on Gaza, Israel and the courts have been attempting to deny the historical existence of Palestinians. When we had Basil Adra on the program to talk about what's happening in the West Bank, we were talking about these attempts but that are used by the Israeli judicial system, right? Judges making arguments that Palestinians, they didn't really live in this land. They didn't really exist, right? So it's erasing people in history with the goal of trying to erase them in the present, right? These are real attempts to eradicate and push out a group of people. And we have to start from there. Then there's the American role. In this, America has played a massive role in condoning and allowing this to happen, as we've seen all across the globe has played a major role in these horrors. And then you see in this country the way that people talk about it, and at a certain point you can get frustrated with people in your personal life, right? Very justified to do so. But you look at the way that the United States Congress is acting right now, where a ceasefire is something that's out of bounds. You have that bumbling idiot, John Fetterman, not only not supporting a ceasefire, but in many ways cheering on the mass slaughter of Palestinians. And it's disgusting when you see, for example, like centrist liberals who denied the reality of what life is like in America in the service to defeat a Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, mm-hmm. Let's call it that, right? It's disgusting to sit here and talk about how things are all fine and dandy in this country. The medical system works. Oh, we just need some tweaks, right? But there's something about this that is just so fucking clear, that we are seeing what is happening in Gaza right now. And there are people who are spending their times not only bending over backwards to deny the atrocities, but actually to try to lay more of a foundation, to shore up the foundation, to protect the foundation for these things to continue. It is the height of an extreme inhumanity that we have to defeat completely.
Yeah. Yeah, what else is there to be said?
I mean, this graphic, for people who are listening, I think, you know, really...
Yeah, I'll spell it out. It's the Independent, one of the newspapers I actually enjoyed picking up when I was a fact checker in London a decade ago. It's left of center. Middle East, who backs immediate ceasefire? Yes. On the yes side, tons and tons of flags. On the right side, Israel, America, and Britain.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to talk more in depth about this with Derek Davison in just a second. We also have a fun little update on an American controversy about grocery stores.
Yes. So Reason Magazine has waded in. You might be expecting a little bit more savvy of a take on the grocery store communism than Tim Pool had. And you'd be mistaken because it's not. But we're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah. So all that and more and plenty in the post game coming up, folks. But first, let's get over to our conversation with Derek Davison. You know him from Foreign Exchange and from the excellent American Prestige podcast. We really appreciate him taking some time and for all of his work and analysis in general.
Welcome, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother.
Joining us once again is Derek Davison. Derek is the proprietor of the Foreign Exchange's newsletter, FX_newsletter on Twitter, and co-host, along with Danny Bessner, of the American Prestige Pod. Derek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Derek's both American Prestige and FX newsletter, I think, are indispensable at normal times, but especially in, you know, emergencies like the one we're seeing now in Gaza. There's a few things I wanted to cover with you, Derek. The first being hostages. Hostages are a big, you know, you see a lot of celebrities demanding Joe Biden release the hostages.
That was a good one. Like, what is Joe Biden going to do exactly to release the hostages? I love that one. That's great.
Keep bombing Gaza, I think, is the implicit message there somehow. But yeah, like, and we also see hostages be released, and the sort of different ways we want to relay that information. The image of one of the released hostages shaking hands with a Hamas operative is causing a lot of stir. I'm curious, like, people come to this. And maybe not super read in, but they know hostages are at play here. What do you tell those people?
I mean, I think you tell them, like, taking hostages is a war crime. It's rightly regarded as an atrocity. It shouldn't happen. These people should all be released. But what's done is done. You know, in this, that sense, they are taken. They are in Gaza. And bombing Gaza to rubble and then bombing it some more until, I guess, you like de-atomize the molecules of the rubble that you've created, is not going to get them home alive. Like, that's not a strategy. Neither is a massive ground invasion that just goes in, you know, shoot first, ask questions, never. I think it's right to be outraged that they were taken. It's right to, feel anger about that or however you respond to it. But if you want to get them back alive, then the only way to do that is to negotiate and to give whatever mediators are you're using, the Red Cross, Qatar, Egypt, you know, whoever is playing mediator at this point, to give them time to try and work something out. And yeah, that means potentially giving concessions to Hamas, I guess, although they haven't really given Hamas anything yet for the hostages that have been released. And I don't know that they're necessarily looking for anything substantial for these civilian hostages. I think, you know, in the case of military personnel they would probably demand the release of Palestinian prisoners. But the civilians, you might have to, you know, turn on, like, allow fuel back in, or you might have to do something that seems, you know, a little bit, you know, if you're really gung-ho, don't negotiate with hostage takers or whatever, if that's your position, then recognize that like most of these people are probably going to die if that's the stance that you take. So, you know, that's how I would kind of lay it out, I guess, if I were
trying to talk somebody down. Yeah, because like I think the concern about the hostages is a real one. And so we somehow have this shift happen where, no, it's actually about teaching people a lesson about terrorism. And then it's like, what's the actual priority here? Because the truth is there are a lot of Palestinians in Israeli jails as well, and an increasing amount post this thing. And like, I guess you say we never want to give terrorism a win, but that means you are sacrificing those hostages.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people say this all the time, and you see it again and again in places where this sort of thing is more common. You know, it hasn't been, it's been years, I think, since Hamas took any hostages, and in that case, it was a very small operation. But you see it in other places where kidnapping for ransom, just pure kidnapping for ransom, like leave aside all the political context or the idea of prisoner exchanges, where that kind of stuff goes on. And the line from the government is always, well, we never negotiate. We don't pay ransom. We don't do anything. But it always, I mean, when these people wind up, to the extent that any of them wind up being released, and many of them do, you know, they've gotten something. They've paid a ransom. They've negotiated. They've done something that they, you know, say on principle they won't do. But it's always more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember a piece in the Guardian I read during the war on terror, and it was looking back and it's like, actually, you do have to negotiate with terrorists if you want cycles of violence. And that specific case study was Ireland. And yeah, like negotiations are preferable to the, you know, this sort of slaughter. So this brings us to this other sort of thing. David and I have called Joe Biden the press release president certain times because he'll announce something that sounds great, like we're going to look really hard at what's going on in Yemen or whatever, and the details aren't ever as quite as bolstering to confidence. We're seeing anew this Joe behind the scenes Biden that, you know, he's today he's saying, you know, I don't know if I trust the Palestinian death counts despite those.
Yeah, that was really grotesque. I mean, just don't say anything. Yeah. Like, I don't know who you're trying to impress with that, but that's just vile to look at these people who are being bombed to smithereens and staring at the, you know, what's still, I mean, and it's been delayed, so who knows, but what still looks like it's going to be a massive ground invasion in which thousands more of them, tens of thousands maybe, are going to be killed. And to say, well, I don't believe that many of you are dying. Like, I don't have any facts to back this up, as Herman Cain said, friend of the pod. I just don't believe it. I don't believe you, basically, when you tell me that this is what's happening. Just ugly stuff, really.
Well, what do you make? I mean, this has been something that's been said by a lot of, you know, experts or people being interviewed on NPR and you know, those kind of publications.
You can put experts in air quotes there, I think.
You know, that Joe Biden is, you know, employing his classic bear hug strategy, where he sort of makes the, you know, has the media appearance for the kind of people like very hardcore pro-Israel folks. Oh, you know, Joe Biden's staying very firm with Israel, but kind of secretly when he's holding Netanyahu in his arms, he's whispering, you know,
whispering his ear, like, knock it off, pal. Yeah. Cut it out, man.
I mean, what do you make of that?
I mean, it's funny to like, cause it's just sort of the scramble for liberals, I think, who want to insist that Joe Biden is doing good in the world. I mean, I guess my question is what is he prevented from happening? Like, this has been awful. They cut off food, water. They've now allowed a trickle, just the barest trickle of humanitarian aid to come back into Gaza, totally inadequate to the requirements. They've tried to ethnically cleanse Gaza City. They haven't managed to do it because they're still bombing southern Gaza, which is where they told everybody to go. And people who have evacuated who wound up in southern Gaza with no place to live and are still being bombed anyway. Many of them have decided, you know, screw this, I'm going home. Understandably, I think. You know, the hospitals are, if they haven't already shut down, are on the verge of shutting down. This is people on dialysis because they don't have any fuel to run generators or to run the power plant. So this is people on dialysis. This is kids in incubators. This is, you know, people who are on any number of other life-saving machines are going to die. They're going to die. Like, there's no medical care. I mean, there's medicine now coming in the barest sense, again, in these very inadequate humanitarian shipments. But you can't replicate that stuff. You're not letting anybody out. You're not even letting foreign nationals out, which is amazing to me because you watch the lengths that Western governments in particular went to get their people out of Israel after the initial attack, to evacuate Israel as though all of Israel were now suddenly in danger, which, you know, I guess you could say from the rocket attacks, but this has gone above and beyond how these governments typically respond in situations like this. They've gone to such extents to get people out of Israel, and they're doing nothing, like absolutely nothing, to get anybody out of Gaza, even their own citizens, to their, you know, holders of their passports who are waiting to be allowed out. They're doing nothing. So it's just been thorough. And now, you know, we haven't even gotten to the bombardment, which has been incessant. And, you know, you keep hearing about, well, they're going to intensify the bombardment. How? Like, how much more can you do here? You know, within, what was it, 6 days or a week or something, they dropped like 6,000 pieces of ordnance on a place that's, you know, barely larger than a, you know, it's, I think, like the New York to Washington DC corridor, that's about the size of it. Just a, you know, one of the most densely populated places on earth. Like, what is he preventing, I guess, would be is how I would respond. Like, what is the whispering in BB's ear and telling him to restrain himself? What's the restraint? What's the evidence of that? Is, you know, were they gonna drop a nuke on these guys and right. forestall that? Like, what, how much worse could this be?
Yeah, exactly. If this is like a 8, then what is a 10 look yeah. like? Yeah, exactly. I think that is exactly right. And I keep remembering, you know, books on the Cold War and Kissinger and how he would be talking to liberal journalists the entire time, being like, actually, you know, we need to look tough because of this Cold War stuff, but really we're doing all this humanitarian stuff and we're really talking to him. And yeah, it's, that's clearly just, that's useful more than truthful.
Could you talk a little bit just like on the aid thing, just to catch people up? You know, what are the hurdles right now on getting aid into Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, the hurdles, the big hurdle, according to the Egyptian government anyway, which is sort of overseeing one half of this process, the big hurdle is that the Israeli military keeps attacking the Rafah checkpoint. I mean, they keep bombing it. You know, every time they're sort of like, they keep hitting the Palestinian side, the Gazan side. And then, you know, at one point they hit an Egyptian guard post on the Egyptian side and we're like, oops, sorry about that. So, you know, if you ask the Egyptians, it's, you know, we can't go any faster because they keep bombing. The roads are damaged. The infrastructure is, you know, damaged and it's, you have to do inspections and it's hard to do that, you know, under a state of open warfare, I guess. So, you know, that's I think a big part of it. I suspect there are or I imagine there are other logistical issues here. I mean, you know, the fact that you're not allowing fuel in makes it difficult to distribute aid, in addition to, you know, the problems that it creates in terms of electricity and not being able to turn the power plant back on creates challenges in distributing this stuff around Gaza. So you sort of have to pick a main point of retrieval, and you're asking people to brave airstrikes to come and pick up this stuff that they need to survive. So, yeah, it's, you know, everything here is screaming for a ceasefire, or at least, you know, one of these inadequate humanitarian pauses that the Biden administration now says it supports after it vetoed a UN resolution that would have called for humanitarian pauses. You know, there's everything kind of screaming for something like this. And, you know, we just don't see it.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about the evacuations of Americans. There's other talk of a wider evacuation preparation for Americans in the Middle East, and I've seen your concern that that's in preparation for a broader regional war. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty convinced that things are going to escalate, and I think the only question is how much. You know, that there's going to be some response. We've already seen some response. I mean, over the last week, I think there've been 13 attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria from various militias, mostly Iraqi militias. The Hezbollah-Israeli border, the Lebanese-Israeli border has been in constant, essentially constant artillery fire, daily at least, between Hezbollah and Israel since this started. You know, we saw at one point the Houthis in Yemen tried to apparently fire some cruise missiles in the general vicinity or general direction of Israel. The U.S. Navy shot them down. So, you know, there's every potential for fault lines all over the region to explode here. And it seems like the Iranians, who are kind of patron to all of these groups, have said that they view the ground invasion as sort of the moment where, you know, they don't phrase it like we're going to tell everyone, you know, we're to fire the starter's pistol and tell everybody to get moving. But it's sort of like this is the moment where everything's going to really pop off once this starts. And that's been their quote unquote red line throughout all of this. So I do think some escalation is sort of baked in at this point, and the U.S. military is, you know, moving air defenses into the region. As you say, they've made these contingency plans to get people out. I think that's sort of a worst case scenario if there is like a full blown regional war, like, you know, of the likes of which we really would not want to see. But the fact that they're even planning for it suggests that they think it's a possibility.
I don't want to like put you in the position of having to make predictions or anything like that. But, you know, when you hear that kind of rhetoric from Iran, I mean, like how credible do you think that is in terms of any kind of, you know, extension of conflict and actors in the area?
I mean, I don't think anybody wants to I don't think any mm-hmm. of the players here want to get things escalated to that level. There are credibility issues here for groups like Hezbollah, for the militias, for Iran itself, you know, that they've supported the Palestinian cause, that Iran has made itself sort of the champion in some respects of the Palestinian cause, as all these Arab countries have kind of gone over and done deals with the U.S. and with Israel to normalize relations. So, I mean, there is an issue here of like, you know, put up or shut up, I think, to some extent. But, you know, Hezbollah isn't in position. I mean, Lebanon is, mm-hmm. before all of this, Lebanon was a mess. It's imploded. The political system is threadbare. The economy is in total shambles. And Hezbollah's popularity, I mean, to the extent that it's part of the it's made itself part of the political machine and maybe one of the dominant players in the political machine. I think their image in Lebanon has suffered for that, as people have turned on that machine for the corruption and the ineffectiveness. So, you know, if they're viewed as pulling Lebanon into a war that isn't necessarily what the Lebanese people want, that's not good for them. So I don't think mm-hmm. they want to do that. But you know, these kinds of things sometimes go where they want to go without you know, even if nobody wants them to go there.
I'm curious, you know, the Ukraine-Russia, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I've always thought like the way to actually address this is to build a world consensus. In part, that is, you know, not there because of our support for, you know, things like Israel and how the rest yeah. of the world sees our sort of rhetoric on the world stage when it comes to whether democracy or genocide or something like that. How does this leave us? Geopolitically, both, you know, particularly in regards to Russia and Ukraine, but just generally,
this is the thing, and this is before all of this started. The Israel-Palestine I don't know what you want to call it, situation. I mean, nobody likes to call it conflict now for some reason because right. they think that implies equality between the sides. I don't think that word itself inherently says that. But Israel-Palestine is the number one thing that undermines the U.S. when it goes out to the world and says, well, we're standing on the side of, you know, human rights and dignity and, you know, freedom versus the evil autocrats. And you should stand with us when Russia invades Ukraine. You should be on our side with Ukraine and against Russia. And then they look at the way that the U.S. responds every time, you know, Israel annexes a bit of territory or, you know, lobs a few hundred missiles into Gaza. And, you know, what are you talking about? Like, what side are you really on? You know, the first and Trump was an aberration in this in terms of rhetoric, in terms of just not even bothering to talk about this stuff. But the first press release or big policy announcement that this State Department had when Biden took over was we're recentering human rights in U.S. foreign policy. This is going to be the big thing. And, you know, it's a joke. I mean, it's really just it's proven over and over again to be nothing but words. Yeah. And this, you know, and to see the U.S. now come, you know, in this conflict and just go all out, even as the Israeli military already is responding in disproportionate ways to what happened. And I don't want to minimize or diminish the horror of what took place to, you know, on October 7th. But, you know, they are killing thousands of people. They're starving people. They are dehydrating people. This is collective punishment on a mass scale, a place that holds about 2.3 million people. And it is, you know, abominable. And you watch the U.S., which, you know, again, we believe in human rights and human dignity. Well, you don't act like it. So why should anybody listen to you? And you know, I don't think this is a huge deal geopolitically, because countries are going to do, governments are going to do what they want to do anyway. And this idea that, like, well, we, you know, the U.S. is hypocritical. Everybody's hypocritical to some degree. And, you know, you're going to find an excuse to do what you want anyway. But it doesn't help. It doesn't help win over anybody to your point of view when you just, you know, go, you repeatedly show that your words are nothing but words.
Yeah. And like on that, I mean, could you, there's just been, you know, from the get-go, I mean, it's always been, you know, notable what comes out of the United Nations in regards to Palestinians' lives and dignity and Israel's actions. But in the past couple of days, I mean, things have really taken quite an incredible turn with Israel basically saying that they're going to refuse access to UN officials. You know, could you talk a little bit about like Israel's like hardline stance against the United Nations? And like, again, like, I mean, I think everyone who listens to this podcast and stuff, we know, like, you know, the limitations of the United Nations, right? For what it proclaims to be and what it actually is able to do feasibly. But I mean, this is just pretty naked, basically, what we're seeing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's sort of, you know, Antonio Guterres, they had a Security Council meeting about Gaza, another one. I think this was their second or third one on Wednesday. And Guterres said, you know, we condemn the attacks of October 7th, but we also have to acknowledge that there are war crimes happening in the response and, you know, atrocities that need to be stopped. And we need to understand that, you know, those attacks took place in a context. They didn't happen in a vacuum. There is a historical context here. And, you know, like, kind of mild stuff, really. Nothing that's like egregious. Like, he wasn't saying, yeah, they deserved it. Good for Hamas. The UN supports, you know, raping, slaughter of civilians. He wasn't saying anything like that. But the Israeli government is so fragile on this point that they are demanding that he resign now because he had the temerity to say that this isn't all 100% good guys versus bad guys and talk to us like we're all five.
The children of light versus
children of light versus you know, that's not genocidal. God, I mean, that's just normal things that you say about stuff. You know, he didn't call the people in Gaza human animals. So I guess, you know, he's not qualified to be Secretary General of the UN anymore. It's kind of silly. And now, as you say, they're not going to let UN personnel into Israel, which is, you know, a convenient way, I guess, to keep anyone from monitoring what's going on in Gaza, or keep anyone from the UN from getting in to monitor what's happening in Gaza. So that may be an ancillary benefit there. It's just a fragility. I mean, I think people who have noticed how back-footed the Israeli government has been over the last, you know, almost 20 days now, I guess what's 18 days. I think they're right. I think, you know, first of all, the attacks themselves were shocking, and I can understand why. I think, you know, part of the reason they were more successful than I suspect even Hamas and company thought they would be is because this Israeli government in particular has treated Gaza as an afterthought and has moved military resources to the West Bank, for example, to help settlers, you know, carry out pogroms on Palestinian villages. So they weren't ready for it. But I think also there is a definite, it's not anything that's, you know, it's not enough to really shift anything politically yet, but there's a definite sense that popular understanding of this situation has changed, I think. There's more understanding of the conditions that the Israeli government has left the Palestinians in, that this is an apartheid state, that Gaza has been effectively an open-air prison camp for 16 years now. And that, you know, people are aware of these things in a way that I would say, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they weren't. And it's not as easy for the rhetoric or the propaganda to sort of snow people under and get them back to that place of children of light versus children of darkness and just shut up, you know, turn off your pretty little head. Don't worry your the pretty little brain about this. Just let us take care of it. And I don't think they're quite. I don't think they know how to respond to that yet. And it's got them lashing out at, you know, for example, relatively mild statements from the Secretary General of the UN and just kind of having a conniption fit that he dared to note some historical facts with relation to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely like my experience of, you know, awareness about Israel-Palestine. The word cloud in like 2008 was like, terrorist, human shield, these sorts of things. And now those things are definitely still here, but you hear settlement, you hear occupation, right, and things like that. And yeah, that is, you can see why there's maybe some alarm. Derek Davison, Foreign Exchanges, and that's foreignexchanges.news, and also American Prestige with Danny Bessner. Derek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys.
I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure to talk to Derek there.
Yeah, I think Derek is, you know, I mean, folks, if you are somehow like here from the TMBS days and, you know, our foreign policy coverage there and don't follow Derek Davison, you know, you're fucking up, I think is the simplest way to put it.
Well, we're going to talk more on Gaza in the post game. We have one more segment coming up, though. But you can get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. Particularly, we're going to talk about a character who I find to be extremely odious. I found him to be odious for a long time for what he sort of represents and what he advocates for in American politics. We're talking about David Pakman here, but particularly for what he has supported internationally. People forget that this is somebody who was a cheerleader of one of the most rabid and brutal right-wing coups in our lifetime, which was the coup of Evo Morales, where Christian nationalists took over the country of Bolivia, tortured, harassed, and killed Bolivian workers, indigenous people, all in the service of global American capital. That was an event that he was very supportive of, and it shouldn't be surprising to anybody here.
It might be surprising. Sorry to cut in, but I just think I want to underline something you said about the Christian sort of extremist element of that coup regime. which, yeah, it went to bat for. Ultimately, mm-hmm. that process, which was a similar type of coup attempt, so we see a play out like that. And that whole, I remember Pacman early on being like the sort of like new atheist kind of guy, right? And I mean, it's just interesting where this goes.
So we're going to be talking obviously about what he's been saying about Gaza, but I'll tell you one thing. This is. Goes back to my initial dislike of somebody like this. It all comes down to this. I'm just a reasonable guy who sits here and weighs all options and can't sit here and tell you one thing or another, even though I'm going to heavily imply and promote one thing. So anyways, I don't want to spoil the lead. We're going to talk in depth about that in the post game. But before we get to that, we have to take a little bit of a look on something we talked about a little while ago. Thought leader and boy genius Tim Pool discovered an attempt by mayor of Chicago to do something about food deserts in the city of Chicago. And he had a pretty dire warning about what was coming next. We have an update a little bit on this question of socialized groceries chains.
Yeah, so Reason Magazine is joining the fold based on a Wall Street Journal piece which profiles Dollar Generals and their expansion. And, you know, I driving down to North Carolina a few months ago. Dollar Generals are out there. I don't know if we had them in the Dakotas. I think there's some in Minnesota. Maybe there's some
I'm
in
sure
Dakotas
you have
now.
Them now in the Dakotas, yeah.
Right, exactly.
The fastest growing business in America. Sorry, I'm just saying, like, it's important to note. It's the fastest growing business in America, has been for a while now, because it comes in and it provides people with very cheap options, but very unhealthy ones. And also is able to go into poor communities where there is a pretty exploitable labor force, which is why particularly like Southern labor groups have been doing a lot of work trying to organize workers of Dollar Tree and Dollar General. Anyway,
indeed. Yeah,
just that's a free market solution to the problem of food deserts. Anyway,
well, I mean, also kind of creating them too, because you know where there are grocery stores, they undermine those by saying we'll handle the Coke and chips. You just handle the veggies. But also this Wall Street Journal piece, I the article's paywalled. I ain't going to pay for Wall Street Journal. But you can watch the piece, and it does say how the workers there are paid more like gas station attendants and grocery. That's just how the Wall Street Journal readers, they pay for that kind of information because it helps them figure out where to invest. Government run grocery store is predictably losing money. The folly of government run grocery stores is sadly not a historical relic of the USSR. Now, again, we need to remind you of a fundamental thing that somehow even gets lost. This isn't just a Tim Pool type amnesia. The reason that these communities don't just decide to do this for fun. DSA hasn't just taken over one of these communities and said, we're going to institute these grocery bins. These are people reacting to the fact that you can't get fucking produce in a grocery store because they're all closing. Because guess what? It is not just going to be the government ones that are unprofitable. It's going to be all of them. That's why they're all closing. That's why they have to think about the logic here is just so fucking unbelievable. And I am pleased to see how feeble this attempt is because it's like, look, another champion comes to with their steed and they're ready to joust. And let's see how real this is. So Eric Bame, there's a lot of Bames in North Dakota, but I don't. What bugs me about this is like these motherfuckers give a shit about rural America at all. I think they want to use it to score points because otherwise you would note that actually food deserts in rural America are a big problem. And it's not just the stupid Kansas municipal grocery store that's losing money that had to come in and fill a gap that wasn't being provided by the market. Anyway, back to this. Chicago's government. Oh, wait. Yeah, this is how it does start. Chicago's city government is infamously corrupt and unable to provide basic services like education, public safety, consistent. Lee, but Mayor Johnson is pushing for the city to also try running a grocery store. Now, I will just say, like, there's a little bit of old-timey, like, dog whistle. A lot of governments are corrupt. Like Chicago one, you know, I mean, the Daily Machine, sure. I don't know if like that's, I think that's kind of been dealt with though by like a mayor like Brandon Johnson. Anyway.
Honestly, it's a good point. Johnson is not coming out of the Democratic Party boss machine.
Exactly.
He was opposed by actually by those forces. So.
Yeah, exactly. This is a little bit, which have like degenerated from like the time where this was a super relevant reference, which is like honestly waning by the time Obama was running for the first time. It wouldn't be the first government-run grocery store and not even the first one in the United States, if you could believe that. For some context about what Chicago is planning, the Wall Street Journal dispatched a reporter to check out the municipal-owned grocery store in Erie, Kansas. And these motherfuckers say we're out of touch, which opened in 2021. How's it going there? Not great. Erie Market, which the city took over in 2021, is losing money almost every month amid stiff competition from Walmart 15 miles away and a Dollar General across the street. Yeah, probably the same stiff competition that drove the other place out of business too. Yeah. Reports the Journal's Joe Barrett. Erie Market posted just a single profit a month during 2022 and lost $132,000. Maybe Erie's erstwhile grocers didn't realize that, unlike the other government
services.
These
guys are so fucking dumb.
I know, man.
Keep going.
Maybe they didn't realize, unlike other government services, grocery stores are subject to competition. Bummer. Yeah, man. I mean, again, the same competition, that means there just wasn't a store there. But city officials aren't giving up, they tell the Journal. Meanwhile, also, I just want to sidebar there. Like, this whole Dollar General thing. And then Tim Pool and those motherfuckers accuse us of the ones who want to take your steaks away. They want to
not,
make
not just your
bugs.
Steaks, but the ones who want to fill you up with junk food.
Exactly.
Because right? They do that exactly. Weird, like, health right wing thing. Yeah.
Hey, where's our boy at? Oliver Anthony or whatever. Fudge rounds. Yeah. You can get your fudge rounds at Dollar General. Let's do a song about how we need. I mean, look, get some red peppers, some bell peppers, right? Let's do a song, man. I'm not going to do the voice because I can't sing as well as Oliver can. A bummer. But city officials aren't giving up, they tell the Journal. Meanwhile, the store's manager says the goal is to lose only $10,000 this year. In other words, maybe Erie $100,000. Yeah, sorry. $100,000 this year. In other words, maybe Erie should give up. And then here we go. This is what's so great about how there is to the libertarian imagination. To be sure, running a grocery store is tough. Low-margin business with tons of competition. Damn, we're getting real business school around here. There's nothing shameful about a brand new business losing money in that environment unless that money belongs to taxpayers, many of whom probably aren't even using the government-run store. I mean, this is up for elections. Yeah. In Chicago, officials envision a city-owned grocery store as a way to address food deserts in neighborhoods where privately owned grocery stores had closed and moved away. Rather than trying and inevitably failing to duplicate those services at the public expense, Johnson should instead listen to why the likes of Walmart and Safeway have bailed. Now, I will also just point out that Erie is but one of the municipal-run grocery stores that we profile. There's another one, I can't remember what the town name is, in the panhandle of Florida. And that one was breaking even as recently as this summer. So just something that maybe you would want to note if you were doing a holistic view of this this phenomenon.
But also geniuses at Reason and Tim Pool and all these folks. The whole point of this argument and this attempt from cities to do this is because the private sector is failing. Because when the private sector deals with a loss like this, or like especially a big corporation, they're like, oh, wait, it doesn't matter to us if people in this community have food or not. We're going to shut down and move out. The reason that you have a publicly run grocery store is so that people have access to food, have access to a grocery store, even if the kind of general economic conditions in the town aren't suitable for somebody to make a bunch of fucking money on top of it. The point is that the loss is the investment in making sure that people have a grocery store to buy potatoes.
Exactly. No, that's just like pure, like how you look at the ledger, because what I'm hearing is you subsidize your folks' groceries, the taxpayers, to a tune of $100,000. Cool. Sure. Yeah. That's better than going to the fucking Dollar General and I'm doing, I guess, what do we want for dinner tonight? Do we want Cool Ranch Doritos or do you want Funyuns? Shit, I'm feeling like Funyuns tonight. Yeah, anyway, there's still a little bit more in the psyche to be revealed here, actually. Yeah, unless that money belongs to taxpayers, many of whom probably aren't even using the government-run store. Now, that is just an assertion. Because what if a lot of them are? Then again, that ledger looks a lot better. Because we're able to buy really good groceries in our community. If like the 1,000 people that live in Erie, Kansas are using it, which I think they are. That's what the local news reports show. In Chicago, officials envision a city-owned grocery store as a way to address food deserts in neighborhood. But rather than trying it, it would never be failing, blah, blah, blah. Johnson should instead listen to why the likes of Walmart and Safeway have bailed. Oh, yeah, let's just listen to the corporations. Grocery operators have pointed to crime and homelessness as reasons they've needed to invest more in security, driving up costs, Chicago Sun-Times reported earlier. Now, I will hazard a guess, and I do think a lot of these folks underplay how big of an issue violent incidents are in red states and in rural communities, because I think that there's a lot of it and too much. But I would hazard a guess that that's not Erie, Kansas's issue, is all the crime. I think it's probably to do with the fact that Americans are poorer than they were expected to be. We've seen a massive swindle of wealth to the top over generations. And now all of a sudden, they don't have as much to pay for it. And I want to bring in our boy LBJ now. Like, we have a lot critical to say of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Better domestically than JFK. JFK, I think, better foreign policy, is how I'll say that. But anyway, without getting into that, this is a conversation he had with a guy, George Smathers, who was a Florida senator. And they're talking about Barry Goldwater. And this is a little bit more deeper economics than you'll get at Reason Magazine, where they're talking about, Smathers talks about a grocery store sort of a magnet, telling him and say, yeah, we can't have Goldwater be president because he wants to immiserate people and, you know, like basically do what Reagan did and neoliberalism did, which is to swindle the poor and completely decimate labor. Smathers points out that actually from a grocery store tycoon's perspective, it's good for a community to have money in their pocket because they're going to come spend it at your place. So here's just a little bit of that conversation.
Pepe.
Oh, let me go here.
Biggest, most successful business. And overseas and attacking China and a few things like that to go to war before, we're going to swing them back.
Main thing that ruined y'all is his economic policies. He's jerking in here and saving $5-10 billion.
Now, so he's talking about Goldwater's economic policies. I do want to note one thing here. Unlike Nixon, who let his taping system start automatically and it basically captured everything, which was kind of a problem at a certain point for him, LBJ turned his on when he wanted to. So that he fires it up mid-conversation here means that he either wants a record for this for himself or maybe even wants to use this politically. So I just want to point that out. You have to keep that in mind because LBJ is tricky.
He's jerking in here and saving $5-10 billion and he's pulling out of every foreign country and he's telling them all to go to hell. And what you do, your export trade that we've got a $6 billion surplus of, you'd be backed by a god grass and be going in the streets. And these gold guys wouldn't have this prosperity in these jobs.
Winn-Dixie, I just talked to his son named J.E. Davis, who is probably the biggest, most successful businessman in the whole Southland. He owns this big chain of grocery stores, Winn-Dixie and Quick Check and Colonial and so on, the whole thing. Just this minute, got off the phone with him, and he was saying, he said, I tell you what, he said, I'd be damned if I can be for Goldwater. And he said, my whole program, and I do $1.7 billion worth of business a year. And he said, it's based on the Democratic type philosophy of economics, eh? And he said, we may have a little bit of inflation. Out of hell, I'd rather have a little bit of inflation than to go back to the days where everybody's pulling in, nobody's buying things. He said it would kill us.
So I see old Stats Coleman sent him $50,000.
So yeah, then LBJ changes the subject to talk about how some donor went away from him. But yeah, I thought those, I mean, kind of fucking obvious, right? And so, yeah, we look around us. Reason Magazine likes to occasionally stand in for the common man that's been left behind by the elites. It's this shit, you stupid fuckers, here. They're not having grocery stores because they've been immiserated financially, because we are helping money circulate to the top. And so, like, is there anything else? Oh, yeah. So they go on to talk about crime. They go on to talk about taxes. Again, I don't think property taxes are the problem in Erie, Kansas. I think it's more that it's not worth the capitalists' fucking time to go there and do that for those people. I mean, it's crazy.
It's a clear-as-day example of the failure of their entire philosophy, is that the free market is going to be able to solve these problems. We have had decades upon decades of this crisis of food deserts across the United States, as working people have continued to struggle under the pro-free market policies of both the Democratic and the Republican Party all across the United States of America. And that is meaning that everything is breaking down. Everything in this country is breaking down, from our healthcare system to even something as basic as food.
Yep.
And this attempt here, you know, also, like, it doesn't patch up, you know, the final problem, right? Which is that we need more money in working people's pockets. We need to cut out these middlemen in general. But yeah, if the free market is going to fail at providing a place for people to go and get groceries so that they can survive and be healthy, yeah, it makes a hell of a lot of sense to have the government come in there and say, hey, yeah, we'll eat $100,000 a year loss if that means that our community can have a fucking grocery store. You know, why subject all of these people to the personal gratification of some fucking asshole?
Yeah.
And if the people, if the government of Chicago, if the question at the end of the day, which is implied in this, right?
Yeah.
Is that the government of Chicago is listening to the people instead of the grocery store chain owners and the Walmart chain owners. They're not listening to those owners, and they should be ignoring the people. I'm sorry. I'll very happily plant my flag. And it's like, no, I think you should listen to the everyday people instead of the fucking asshole grocery store.
Yeah. Owners. You know, I'm doing the math here, and, you know, it's not actually that hard of math, but just to let people know, in order to have a fucking grocery store, Erie, Kansas, city of 1,000, to lose $100,000 a year, that is $100 per resident, folks. Like, imagine that as a subscription service. Rebrand that as a fancy little thing that you can advertise on podcasts. That's actually not a bad deal.
$10 a month.
I mean, Christ. And the idea that it's just, again, like, this is why you can tell these, you know, snakes don't care about these people that they're talking about, is, yeah, you think it's just the ones, the public ones that are having issues. Again, like, we have to keep underlining, none of these communities would be considering doing this in the first place if they were adequately served by capitalist owned grocery stores. And that is such a failing. And so he wraps this up. But what's happening in Erie, Kansas, and what could happen on an even larger scale in Chicago, is a useful reminder that the folly of government-run grocery stores is sadly not a historical relic like the USSR. Yeah, bro, because it's not this form that you only seem to care about, where it's if it's government-run shelf and that goes empty, a government-run store that fails, whatever that means, that is something that you like. I mean, it's like fucking Alexander Solzhenitsyn over here. And then all these people, like, just not served at all by capitalists. All these grocery stores, like, yeah, I guess we just can't afford this. Or I'm retiring because I'm 85. I've been running the grocery store here forever. And, you know, like, my kids don't want to do it because this shit ain't good money. That's as big of a failure. I feel that way about when those people go hungry, or those people have to eat Pringles because there's not, like whatever the hell, like fresh deli. Like, it's sickening. And and then again, like, Tim Pool, bro, to be the one that you're the one who wants everyone to eat bugs and eat trash and take steaks away from people. Yeah. All right. How good are the steaks at Dollar General? the market's providing.
Number one jokers, or as Aaron Brown calls them, the newsmen. Dark as fuck, y'all. Well, everybody, we're going to go over the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning, get access. We'll be taking your voicemails and questions, and we're also going to be talking a little bit about this David Pakman saga, somebody who is, I don't even want to say he's shown his true colors, but I think it's worth exposing them again. And yeah, as Matt just put on the chat there, people check out Tommy's work in Seattle.
Yeah, here, I'll put it up again. Yeah, I mean, with Pakman, I mean, he admitted like years ago, like, I'm not going to talk about Israel-Palestine because it's going to upset people. And I just think that's not a way to be. yeah. You know, I mean, I guess on that note, we have Lily Lynch on for patrons this Sunday. And we'll be discussing her recent writings on Ukraine, Russia. And so if you have questions and you want to give them in, maybe we'll put up something or comment on this.
I'll put up a post on patreon.com/leftreckoning for people if you have any, and I'll post the article too if people have questions. You can submit them there. I'll do that now. But come over, join us the post game. We'll be over there in about 10 minutes or so, and hang out with all of y'all. patreon.com/leftreckoning. Thanks everyone for hanging out with us. As we say, you know, a lot on this program, we couldn't do this without all of your support, and also kind of spiritually and emotionally without this community. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in with us for all these years, and particularly right now. It means a lot to both Matt and I.
Yeah,
we'll be over in the post game in just a second, everybody. See you soon.